I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the
Kate McCone Sweet with us as the co-author of The New Entrepreneurial Leader, Developing Leaders Who Shape Social and Economic Opportunity. She's an associate professor of operations management at Babson College and chair of the Technology Operations Information Management Division. Her work has appeared in publications such as Journal of Operations Management and Production Operations Management. And let us say, Kate, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about the new entrepreneurial leader, what's the difference between a leader today and the leader that we're used to, the leader that we saw, 10, 15, 20 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest difference that we see is what we call an entrepreneurial leader is someone who needs to rely upon a different rationale for the existence of business and also leverages a different logic of making decisions and taking action. And so what our book does is define what that leader is and also think about reinventing management education in order to mold those leaders.
So in essence, you've got to have somebody that's balanced and have the ability to shift and back and forth between left and right brain thinking constantly.
Yeah, exactly. We actually lay out three principles of entrepreneurial leadership, and the first one is really what we call cognitive ambidexterity, and what it's based on is sort of the prediction logic, which we often are well-trained with in an MBA education. So we know different frameworks. We know how to analyze data, and we come up with solutions and then act on our plans. However, when situations are really uncertain and often unknowable, we can't rely on past experience or data to find solutions, and so we have to take action, which is what we call creation logic, taking small steps, learning more about the environment, and then and then building our future plans based on what we learn and taking those steps.
Well, there's something that moves beyond academia, and usually what will occur is somebody will get the academic background to something. They'll know it left, right, and back, left, right, and upside down and backwards, and the ABCs of it. But then there's that wisdom that we have to throw into the mix that happens when they get out into the world and start actually applying and using that wisdom. That's the OJT, the on-the-job training. And
right.
And it seems as though that a true leader is going to have a combination of both of those things and use the optimum in both areas to really succeed in today's economy and that workplace out there.
I agree. I think that's the trick. One is to be able to educate people in terms of using both and then now allowing them to figure out when to use each approach. And that's really the trick. The other thing that we find is that given the business world that we're facing today, people also have to take a more global perspective, a different worldview where they're thinking about social, economic, and environmental value creation at the same time, simultaneously versus sequentially, as it often happens in most businesses. They think about shareholder value creation and then perhaps get around to doing the social or environmental issues. Today, we really can't do that. We need to find opportunities where we can think and work through problems looking at all three perspectives.
You know, interesting point. You said value creation. And value in and of itself is nothing more than a definition of whatever that product or project is out in the marketplace. So value creation is also based on time and place and the marketplace, especially economy and all of those things that you throw into the mix to make sure you've got the right mixture to go forward. So value creation can be something that almost changes on a weekly basis.
It does, and I think that leads us sort of to the third principle of our book, which is thinking about people really need to have a much better understanding of themselves, the passions that they have, as well as the context in which they're operating in. The business world that we see today is not the one that our parents saw. Frankly, it's far more complex. It's far more global. There's ongoing technological changes, financial crises, which change the way that we're looking at the world. Demands for better stewardship for our plants. All of these are really are continuously changing and causing us to have to rechange how we approach a problem.
Also, too, there's something else that we really didn't have 25, 30 years ago. You've got a political influence today that does leave a mark on business in and of itself, whether it be local or global. It's the same thing. We have to look at that not just from our country, but all of the other countries that are participating in any kind of an economic standard. Because the mindsets are so completely different, the values are so completely different, that if anybody's going to be an entrepreneurial leader today, they've got to be able to take all of this together and then move from that with the conditions of each one of these separate societies that get involved here. It's got to be very confusing for somebody starting off fresh today.
Oh, I would agree. One of the classes I teach in operations management is supply chain. And if I look at how I taught operations 20 years ago versus how I'm teaching it now, it's very different. And a lot of that is because we're serving global markets, we have outsourced throughout the world, and we're dealing with employees and customers from very different cultural backgrounds. And it's causing us, really driving the need to customize what we're delivering in each of those areas.
I was going to say, by the way, in the next couple of years, this entire thing can change. The relationship that we have with Japan, China especially, okay, and Japan and India, etc., what's going on in the Middle East right now and what's going on in Asia, there's going to be some drastic changes in the world and in leadership and in the way that we do business. You know, there's a possibility we just might pull everything in from all of the different countries and start remanufacturing and taking care of things here. Possibility, which again changes somebody's ability to reach out and grasp and get a handle on being an entrepreneur.
It's true. I think the call for entrepreneurial is also critical in terms of for years we've thought about entrepreneurial leadership as just new venture creation, but we're really having to think about this in terms of, you know, businesses that establish organizations, how do we do new products, new processes, completely change who our partners are from, you know, one decade to another. We need to think about how social ventures and political parties may be driving change throughout the world. All these types of non-government organizations, government organizations, need to be thinking about a different type of leadership.
No, absolutely, no question about it. Now, I'll tell you what it's bringing me to. Let's say, for instance, that 2012 elections come in and there's a brand new administration, and it might be the brand new kind of administration that say, okay, let's dig for oil. We've probably got $2-3 trillion worth of oil underneath the land in the United States, in and of our borders here. So let's say that happens, and all of a sudden you've got jobs and you've got this economy going in a completely different way. Then we take the jobs away from those people that we partnered up in the Middle East and so on and so forth. And then now all of a sudden you've got a completely different world to look at. The reason I think that your book is so important, The New Entrepreneurial Leader, and especially with what you were talking about with the analytical and the action-oriented approaches combined together, if those leaders that are going to be around in the next 5 or 10 years do not have a base of what you're talking about, everybody's going to be in trouble.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think what we've often done, as a management educator, I think we've been teaching sort of the same way of doing businesses for years, and that's often where we're seeing the failures. What we need to be able to teach people to do is how to learn, be ongoing learners in the environment, and be able to not only rely on old business models and past experiences, but be able to take a more creation-oriented approach to explore new opportunities, whether that be within your own company, within your own country, or overseas, and what those what are your partners going to be doing with you? They may not be your manufacturers, but the employees from that country may in fact be taking on completely different roles. Sure. I think we see this repeating over and over. Every country sort of has, you can start off a low labor cost making products, and then gradually lead up to more technology oriented jobs over the course of a decade, a couple of decades.
Well, no question about it. And if this gets mentioned 1,000 times a month, I think people should start to listen to it. Einstein had it all together when he said we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. And that's really when it's time to tap into our own innovation, that capacity that we have for creativity and, more important, collaboration. And that's what the new leaders are going to have to ground themselves in. They're going to have to be able to move in such a way that change can come rapidly, and they're going to be able to maneuver with that change.
I agree. Throughout our book, we bring in examples of different leaders that have, and some of them are in larger organizations like Clorox, and some of them are in smaller organizations. And I think the examples really help to highlight some of what you're talking about. When I, a student I had probably about 10 or 15 years ago, had been this real advocate for environmental issues and had started his own company and had been looking at solar power, et cetera. But his business idea was completely transformed. Frankly, he turned garbage into an opportunity. He found, he was walking down the Boston streets, he noticed a trash vehicle in action, huge fumes pouring out of it, exhaust, litter all over the street, and he thought, there's got to be a better way. And he started looking into the problem, and he found, garbage trucks consume about 1 billion gallons of fuel in the U.S., and the average truck only goes 2.8 billion gallons. When he started looking about how companies had been solving that problem, municipalities and waste collection services were trying to creak out another 0.1 or 0.2 miles per gallon, which frankly was an incremental change in terms of the environmental impact. So he started thinking about it completely in a different way. It's not really about more fuel efficiency. It's really about reducing the need for efficient collection process. And so what he ended up doing was applying his technologies from solar and created what's called the Big Belly Solar Power Trash Compactor. And you'll see these now in the Boston area. They're all in Fenway. And you see them in a lot of town municipalities and some out in Vail and various areas. And what they do is he was able to reduce energy consumption by about 80%. So the garbage cans now can hold five times as much garbage, and so it reduces the need for the collection. A really simple idea. It took him some time to get to it because, frankly, he was distracted with his other business ideas, but it kept nagging at him. In fact, he used to joke that he said, when I was on my honeymoon, I was taking pictures of garbage cans. And I think looking at this individual, Jim Paas, he really shows sort of the creativity that comes from new leaders. One, they follow who their passion is. They're always conscious of what's going on around them. They gather people together based on who else is interested in it. So he brought in some friends of his from Babson College. He brought in some Olin engineers that he had known and brought them together to really create a whole different solution. And these are the types of leaders that we need ongoing. We need them. I mean, this is a simple example of transforming garbage into an opportunity. But frankly, it's this way of turning a problem upside down and coming out with a new solution. Those are going to be people that can create both social and economic value as we move forward.
Okay, what he found was that, the magic to the whole thing, he found what's called the blind spot. He brought the invisible up to the table. They had this in front of them the entire time, and nobody saw it. So he was there, not necessarily even to create, but to point it out. It happens in businesses too, i.e., you know, just pick a number. You got $100,000 a month gross income, and your net at the end of the month, let's say, is $30,000. And you can't compete with anybody, and you can't make any more money, and there's competition all over the place, and you can't get any new customers, and somebody walks in with an accounting system that can save you $20,000 a month. Now, all of a sudden, you don't have to spend $70,000 to make 30. You're spending a lot less than that, and you're getting a lot more at the end of the month. It's finding that blind spot. It's that solution to the problem that you didn't know was there in the first place. You knew there was a problem, but you couldn't handle it. And you can't fix anything unless you know what that something is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes, you know, some of it's thinking about a problem, thinking about both the prediction and the creation approaches to thinking, bringing in a group. I mean, this is where we can leverage often the diverse groups of employees as well as our partners across the globe. We can apply the different cultural perspectives, the different ways of thinking about problems, and hopefully come up with new solutions.
Yeah, it's the old C word, collaboration. And that's
right.
That's and that's something that's extremely important. And it doesn't come completely externally. It also comes from within. And I think a lot of businesses today and a lot of leaders today forget about the employees that they already have, and that's going to kill them one way or the other. And the end result, it's going to affect their income at the end of the month, that bottom line. All right, let me ask you this. I picked the book up. I have it in front of me, by the way. I picked the book up, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get from The New Entrepreneurial Leader that I didn't have before I read it?
I think there's two things. I mean, the book was initially targeted for a management education audience, and I think that's still our primary audience. And for them, we've offered a solution to reinvent the management education. There's lots of thought leaders that have been out there and have criticized management education, but few that have offered a solution. And frankly, our book actually is a how-to book. We give examples in each chapter of how you can educate leaders to become more entrepreneurial, to be the leaders that we need in the future. Now, interestingly enough, it's been broadened out. We've gotten a much broader audience than we initially anticipated. We find that companies that are looking for more innovative solutions are using this to think about how they're developing their new leaders. Policymakers have been asking for copies of the books to really think differently about how they're looking at economic development in the future.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Let me ask you this, Kate. Is there a website we can find you at, find out more about what you're doing, and also get the book?
Yes, it's www.newleaderbook.com. Newleaderbook.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, if somebody missed it, it'll be up on our website, so it will be there if somebody wants to follow up on it. Thank you so much for joining us, Kate, and I've appreciated your time.
All right. Thank you. Have a good
night. Take care. Good night.
Japan and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything.
hoping just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Pat Huddleston with us. He's the author of The Vigilant Investor, a former SEC enforcer reveals how to fraud-proof your investments. He's an attorney and the founder and CEO of Investors Watchdog, a company that conducts fraud investigations for pension funds, endowments, family offices, and individual investors. A former enforcement branch chief of securities and for the Securities and Exchange Commission. He currently serves as a court-appointed receiver in SEC fraud cases. Pat, I welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It's a thrill to be with you, man.
Thank you so much for being here. Don't ask me to say chief of security six times or I'm in trouble.
Yeah, I think you did great, man. I've heard much worse.
I can imagine. Okay, everything is fine as long as you don't tell me that the $6 million I'm getting from Nigeria, as long as I give them my bank account, is not good.
That should be coming tomorrow, I think, right? I
mean, at least. Now, Pat, when we really come down to it, I kid about that, but I get these all the time, and I know that it's not within the realm of the pension funds, endowments, family office,
right,
and individual investors. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we fall prey to this stuff. I get this stuff maybe once every 2 or 3 months. And, Pat, the real message here is if I'm getting it that often, that means somebody falls prey to it. And there are, when we're getting into pension funds, et cetera, you got a little more sophisticated criminal out there looking to defraud you. And I think the people at large are really, they just have no idea who's for real and who's not. So let me start with what got you into this this realm of work in the first place.
Yeah, well, I learned the investor protection mission at the SEC. I joined the government after working in private practice for a few years because I felt like I wanted to do some work that really, really mattered and really helped people. And I found that work at the SEC. I left there in 96 so that I could get more involved with helping individual investors. And private practice has done that for me. In 2006, though, I will always remember the date. I was talking to yet another senior citizen who had lost his entire life savings to a Ponzi scheme. I'd said goodbye to that guy, and it hit me like a physical impact. The thought was, how long are you going to keep having these sad conversations before you do something to protect these people on the front end? And that was the day that Investors Watchdog was born, and we started blogging. We started, gathering information about scam artists nationwide, things that had been expunged from the records of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. We put it all in a database, and then we put up a website and said, hey, we're out there. Thank God a lot of folks have come to us and asked for help, but, we've been frustrated by how few come. And so that led me to write a book because I just really feel passionate about this. I want people to know what I know about how to spot these things because it is not as easy as that old axiom, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. That will keep you safe from the Nigerian scam. But what we say at Investors Watchdog is if it sounds too good to be true, you're probably talking to an amateur because only incompetent or amateurs or rookie scam artists make it sound too good to be true. I'll give you an example. In the past 90 days, I blogged on three scams that promised 5% or less per year. Now, that may be a big number in today's environment and a safe investment, but it's not so big as to bring that axiom into play. And you made the point yourself. I mean, people who target institutional investors, they make these things look absolutely legitimate. So people ask me all the time, what does a scam artist look like? He looks like the face in the mirror. What does a fraudulent investment look like? It will look exactly like a legitimate investment. It's tough to spot.
And I think one of the biggest problems is, and you were saying it, you know, it looks like you, it looks like this, that, you know, there are Bernie Madoffs out there. There's no question about that. But there are really good people out in the investment world also. But the problem is it's distinguishing which one is the good guy and which one is the bad guy. There was no way anybody would have known Madoff was doing what Madoff did up until that time. Obviously, it caught up to him. It had to with a Ponzi scheme. But the point of contention is there are other Madoffs out there, and you're right. They are so sophisticated that you don't know until it's already happened.
Yeah, and so what you have to do is just realize that all the, and you're right, most people out there are good and ethical. There's a huge population of those who aren't. So how do you tell them apart? What you have to do is realize that all of them, the entire universe, is human, and they are prone to make mistakes. And somebody who has access to your nest egg, their mistakes can cost you everything. And so you have to think about and evaluate them more carefully than you would a house painter or a web developer who, if they make a mistake, they can cause you some hassle and maybe cost you some money, but they're not going to put you into a Medicaid nursing home when you had planned on a comfortable retirement. So what I tell people is, look, even if it's your brother-in-law, even if it's your dad, you have got to do these certain due diligence things that we describe in the book. Look in the right places and look for evidence of fraud. I tell people all the time, if fraud is what you're worried about, you have to look for it. Most people, because of these cognitive biases that every healthy human brain has, they tend to look for confirmation of legitimacy. Well, that is not the same inquiry as a fraud inquiry. And so we tell people, you don't have to believe that your brother-in-law is a crook to just go ahead and look in the places where you would find evidence if he was running from a string of judgments, or if he had filed bankruptcy in the past. You just have to make it a discipline to do this every time and realize what the stakes are.
The stakes are much higher today than they were 10, 15 years ago. Money's money, there's no question about it, but the economic condition of the world, I won't even say the country right now, is very iffy, it's very touchy. We talk about, you know, that there's, you know, we're in debt and there's not that much money. That's not true, because I realize that there is a tremendous amount of money out there, but people are just having a hard time letting go because it's not as known as it was what could happen to your money as it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's a crapshoot out there now, which makes it even more dangerous. So, Pat, let me ask you this. Let's say, for instance, that I've got a bunch of money and I want to do some kind of an investment. Somebody comes to me. What are some of the signs that I look for? What are some of these triggers that will cause me to step back and say, I better vet this a little better?
Well, the first trigger is that you, after reading chapter one, you know about how you are inclined to process information that comes from anybody who approaches you with an investment. And then what you have to do, Michael Ray, is you just have to say, first of all, there aren't going to be any decisions made today. If you need my check today or the deal is off, then I'm sorry, friend, the deal is off. If I don't have time to do my due diligence, I can't afford your investment. So if you get any pressure at all to make a decision quickly, you have to step away from it. Just turn your back on it and never think about it again, because that sense of urgency that they are trained to create is designed to overcome your reasoning faculties, to push you past the point at which you can do a meaningful investigation. So any sort of pressure to act right away, you got to turn your back on it. And then what you have to do is get busy. You've got the person's name. We describe in the book where you go to look. You want to find out, you want to look in PACER.gov, PACER.gov. Gives you access to federal dockets coast to coast. If the case was filed in the federal system, it will show you whether they have disappointed investors in previous deals, whether they have a criminal record at the federal level, whether they filed bankruptcy. You're going to go to your state securities commissioner and get what's called a CRD, stands for Central Registration Depository. It'll tell you much more than the free broker check report that you can get from FINRA, which, by the way, has been whitewashed to a certain extent. That CRD will show you what they made on the regulatory exams. You know, did they flunk the stockbroker's licensing exam a couple times before they passed it? Michael Ray, I understand. I mean, I'm not saying anybody could pass it, but it ain't the bar exam, man. It is. No. Two-thirds of it test customer protection concepts that ought to be natural to somebody who wants to be in that business. So if they had a hard time passing it, you know, you have to consider that. Where have they worked? Did they work for 5 years at a firm like Stratton Oakmont? which was a notorious boiler room operation. Now, you understand that means something to me because I've been in this business. It won't mean something to your average investor. It will soon because Martin Scorsese is actually making a movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio about that firm. But if you have somebody who knows the industry, show that CRD to them because experience makes all the difference. And, of course, if you want to check and see if there have been items expunged from their record, you can always call us at Investors Watchdog. Our lowest price product is a broker snapshot report that tells you things that you can't get from any of the sources we've talked about so far. So you have to go into it just knowing you're going to look past what you get in the sales presentation.
Two things. One is no matter what you charge, it is nothing compared to what somebody can lose. So obviously, it's not what you spend. It's what you're not going to lose because you put the money out. The other two things that happen when it, quote unquote, sounds too good. Pat, the only thing that drives people is fear of loss or desire for gain. And decision making is caught between the two of those. And usually, when you're sitting in a situation where somebody offers you something and it looks so good, most people forget the academics of checking them out, and it's, this is what I'm going to get, this is now, and that's where the problem is. It's called taking a breath, bite your tongue, step on your foot, wait about 20 seconds before you make a decision, and do a little checking.
Yeah, and you just have to do it. And I really hope that the stories Individual and Investor help awaken people to just how big this problem is and how close it is to each individual investor. That's why we use stories in every chapter to people learn best that way. And plus, they're really fascinating stories. But they really bring home just how close this is to every single one of us. And I'm afraid there's a perfect storm brewing that is going to threaten to make us forget Bernie Madoff. It is so big. With the baby boomers retiring, regulator budgets being held down, people seeking that number that they had in mind before the financial crisis, that number they need to retire, they're going to be open to people who say, hey, I can get you back to that number, right? People feel like they need to get back there. And the investments that they see from the bank and from, you know, really safe investments aren't getting them there. But I love the way you brought up the fact that it's either, you know, fear of loss or desire for gain, because that points out how fraud never slumps. In a down market or in a volatile market, people are afraid of losing their principal. And so what do scam artists offer? Safe, stable, boring investments. When the market is running, setting new highs, what do they offer? Hedge funds, limited partnerships, things that promise they can match those biggest gains. So fraud never, ever, ever slumps. It's always out there. And, you know, we're beginning to see the first drops fall out of what I think is going to be the new generation of fraudsters who have learned from Bernie Madoff and others how to do it better.
Now, by the way, those people who are going to do it and do it better, quote unquote, we've got a different kind of investor today. I was alluding to that because of the economy and because of people frightened to death, really, of putting that dollar out because they don't know where it's going to go. I mean, even to people who are defrauding people with gold and silver and so on and so forth. But there's a different kind of investor that's coming up. You know, you just said there's a different kind of fraudster. But what about the new investor? Because there are new investors coming up. They look different, they feel different, and they have a different mindset.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a way, they have a different mindset. But it's what I referred to before. I mean, they are investors who thought that they were on a path to a comfortable and stable retirement. And we all got knocked back a few steps, didn't we? And so we're 3-4 years older, and we're farther away than we were, you know, in 2006. And so we are hungry to get back there where we need to be. Not to mention institutional investors. Public pension funds are in the same boat, and you would not believe how many of them fall victim to this kind of thing. And so we also, in this kind of market, people just tend to chase returns. They think, what am I going to get, 0.5% from a bank CD? That won't do. I've got to have something more. And so they start chasing returns, you see. So they start evaluating things. First of all, how much is this going to get me? Now, if that's your first inquiry, you have pushed all the way past, is this thing real, to how much is it going to get me, right? And so what I tell people, if you don't like the idea of 1% for a CD, compare it to the alternative of losing 50 or 100% through a scam that you stumbled into because you insisted on having at least 5 or 10 in a market that could not safely return that. So, I tell people, you know, you can give scam artists a lot of credit, but the truth is that investors do all the heavy lifting. The CIA actually trains its folks on cognitive biases. You know, what a CIA agent uses, his or her tool, is the human brain. And so they start their training by learning about how the human brain processes information. And what they tell their people, they say, look, there's so much going on behind the curtain of your conscious thought that we have to spend some time teaching you about how you're inclined to see things, how to perceive things, if you're going to be effective in your job. And so that's why I spend chapter one of the book trying to teach that to investors. There are three biases we talk about. If you learn them and you can understand that they're going to be in play in the investment context, you can be so much safer. If instead you're just going out there saying, hey, I'm a very skeptical person, no one's going to pull one over on me, well, guess what? You have something in common with all the tens, hundreds of thousands of people who have lost money to investment scams, because it's always the person who thinks they're too smart, too sensible, too savvy to fall for it. Who does fall for it? Who is safe? It's the person who thinks, yeah, that could happen to me. I'm a human being. I could fall for a clever scam. So since that's possible, I'm going to take steps to protect myself. You see, the person who's in the thralls of the what I call the optimism bias doesn't think they need any protection, because they're just the sort of chap or the sort of gal who would never fall for a scam. And that is exactly the mindset that the scam artist wants you to have. He leaps in the air for joy when he comes across anybody who comes across as thinking that they're too smart to be taken advantage of, because they're the easiest people to take advantage of.
One of the things that's going to go on, and it's going to happen fairly quick, it's going to be a great playground for those who defraud. I was listening to the news. I heard something about Medicare, Social Security, et cetera, that's going on maybe in 2012 or a year or so from them. Because of the shortage of money, they are talking about minimizing the amount of times that if somebody's sick, if they're a senior, they can go to the hospital. They may only be able to go seven times a year. If you've got cancer or some debilitating disease, you're dead. So you get frightened. If you get frightened, you start to listen to people. If they tell you a story that sounds like it could be the answer to the problem that you're facing, you talked about brain chemistry, just a little shot of dopamine, that chemical, that feel-good chemical. If you can get me to experience that, you got me.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And you make another point when you mention Medicare, and this may have been where you're going about the new kind of investor. There are a lot of us. I'm a late baby boomer, right? So I won't turn 65 for another 16 years now. And we all realize that Social Security, if it's even going to be there, is going to be far less generous. So this wave of baby boomers who's got, you know, 25, 30 years of savings, 40, 45, 50, we are in the position where we know that this is going to have to take care of us. There isn't going to be likely as generous a kick from Social Security. And so we're even that much more desperate to grow it, right? So it can not only make up for what we expected it to do all along, but make up for the Social Security that we may not be getting.
By the way, you talk about FBI and CIA. You should listen to the next interview, because she's here. Okay. Pat, we're just about out of time. A website we can find you at, please.
If you want to read a sample chapter and read what the reviewers are saying about the book, go to thevigilantinvestor.com.
Okay, thevigilantinvestor.com. Okay, by the way, and thank you so much for being here. And I really believe, and I'm not just saying this, it's guys like yourself that will save a lot of lives out there, because there are too many people who lose too much money and they emotionally can't deal with it and they jump off bridges. So, by the way, thank you so much for being with us, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It was my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
You alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore.
that's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I know the magic of her charms because I want a girl.
Dr. Kathleen Puckett with us, a co-author of The Homeland Insecurity, former FBI Psychological Profile with the Counterterrorism Unit. And she, again, is the co-author of the newest book, is Homeland Insecurity. Hey, Kathy, welcome back.
Hi, Michael. Nice to talk to you after such a long pause.
Yeah, what have you been up to? Anything exciting? I know if you tell me...
Oh, yes.
You'll have to eliminate...
Yes, actually, we've been doing some really interesting things. Terry and I have got some interesting cases going on, and actually I just returned from the Society for Police and Criminal Psychology Conference in Chicago.
Yeah. Chicago, you know what?
That was fun.
You were an hour and 10 minutes away.
I know.
Yeah,
I know. But, Michael, I was there when the weather was, I brought the horrible weather with me, and I took it, and I left, and the weather got beautiful again.
You know what? I'm glad you stayed down. Not really. You know I love you. All right, let's get into
it. It was 65-mile-an-hour winds, Michael.
Oh, I know. Yes, they were up here also. Unbelievable.
Yes.
Yes, nice.
Yes.
But you didn't have to spend a lot of money on gas. You just put the car in neutral and it went.
That's right.
Something like that. I want to get into this because I think this is extremely important, especially with your background and the kind of things that you do. Radio Susie sent you an article, and I started to become aware of this in the last day or two. Obviously, since Gaddafi is gone, everybody thought, well, okay, it's going to be a democratic government and we're going to help the people and whatever. Yeah, I know. And then, but what you're dealing with there as opposed to here is here you've got basically three different mindsets that fight to run the country. You got the Democrats, the Republicans, the Independents, and so on and so forth. And not much more than that. That's pretty much the mindset. There you got 140 different mindsets, 140 different tribes, 140 different ways to look at things. The only overarching theme for the bulk of them, and they're moving in that direction, is Sharia law. And I have a very strong premonition that if we're not very careful and they move the way it looks like they're going to move, I've got a feeling that the Syria and a couple of the different countries, they're going to band together. And I think Israel is going to be in big trouble. And if Israel is going to be in big trouble, we have to make that decision to be able to stand up with them or back off. And
I think that's well said, Michael. I think that when you said that there are 140 different political, organizations over there, it has a lot to do with education and history. And as far as the tradition, the difficulty of imposing democracy on a country that is not structured for it is kind of a historic one for us.
Sure.
You know, we bloomed a democracy in the 18th century here in the British colonies and in the War of Independence, and then we were far enough away from Europe not to be, we had already kicked out the British. We were far enough away to evolve a new democratic system of government, representative government, that was not impinged upon by, you know, 100 other countries like the old world was. So how many other countries have the advantage of an expanding economy, good resources, and education and everything else that the United States developed? We're dealing with countries that are a lot more impoverished in a lot of different ways.
No, absolutely. And as human beings, depending upon whether we're there, we're here, whatever, the degree of what it's going to take to make us follow something is obviously different, but we're human beings, and the human being, if you promise me something that I really want, I'm going to follow you. And I mean, that's the way we are.
Right.
Good, bad, or indifferent. Now, you've got a lot of people, when I say uneducated, hear that in a way that we are talking about people who are told what to do. They're told what to think. And when you're told what to do and what to think, and there's a limitation on their ability to look beyond that, you got a problem.
Right. Well, you know, when they're told what to think, you know, it's interesting. I think that the number of, at the beginning of the, at the dawn of the American era, you know, it was possible for people, even though a lot of people had hard lives, there was always the attitude in this country that you could, you know, and education was part of it, but it was also, there's a positivism that was like, there's opportunity.
Yes.
And in countries like Libya and, you know, certainly Tunisia, and as the article that you sent me, you know, was talking about the whole Middle East, the vast majority of their population doesn't feel that they have any influence on what's going to happen, and they have to be told what to do.
And
like you said, the common dictate is Sharia law.
Yeah. And let me, there's a paragraph at the bottom of this that Gaffney wrote. He said, the problem is that because ultimately they must, according to Sharia law, according to what they believe is God's will, make everybody feel subdued in order to achieve their God-mandated direction, and they'll not remain moderate, and they won't be satisfied with anything less than the ultimate supremacy of Sharia, and they'll certainly not resist the use of violence when it becomes expedient to get their way. Even in this country today, and I'm very spiritual, and you know I'm Jewish, and I believe in God very strongly, but that said, that most people, even in this country, if you say, God does not want you to do that, or God wants you to do this, watch what happens. The fear comes up. How can I do something God doesn't want me to do, and I better do it? That's what it is. And you've got people using that is horrible.
Well, yeah, and they're using it for their own control. And it's not like our kind of evolved political nonsense. They're actually at survival mode. I mean, you're looking at countries like Yemen and, you know, all over the Arab Peninsula, that where the standard of living is so desperate for most of the people in the country, that they're not worried about anything but keeping their children from getting blown up and getting enough bread for their kids.
Absolutely.
That's the difference between, you know, how can you instill even the idea of freedom is so alien to most of them that just having a safe, warm place to sleep and decent food to eat is probably the most that any of them are ever going to expect.
No, absolutely. And when it really comes down to it, you know, with Sharia law, they also have the honor killing. That means if you're my wife or you're my daughter and I don't like what you've done, I can take you out in the back and shoot you, and there's nothing anybody can do to me because that's my right to do so. And
the subjugation of women is. And as far as that makes it really unacceptable just in itself for most Western democracies is the idea that, you know, women are chattel. And that's essentially what they're saying is their property, and they're essentially have no rights, and they're highly valued but severely punished for being women. And it's a really strange system that's so wound up with the religious ideal that they have that, You know, I mean, loving your wife so much that you kill her because she dishonored the family is quite a crazy concept if you really look at it.
Yeah, and she dishonored the family by she glanced at a man out in the marketplace. That's dishonoring
right.
the family. My contention with that basically is this. You said chattel. Chattel is property. And when human beings are property, I cannot in my heart of hearts understand why in this country that we love so dearly that we allow some of the cities and some of the major cities in the states, I said it backwards, are allowing Sharia law. And I take it right back to the woman 2 years ago, I think it was, in Florida, that she was getting a driver's license and she refused to take the burqa off because that was against her religion. What do you do with something like that? If you want to live like that, go somewhere else.
Right, right. Well, you know, someone shouldn't be driving in a burqa.
I know. So get me right.
How can you see where you're going in a burqa?
Good point. But the contention is, with all due respect to some of the people that live in this country that fight for that, I don't necessarily know what they're standing up for and they're fighting for if they really know what it means to live under that kind of law.
Well, I think it's really interesting, Michael, because essentially what you're talking about is, you know, the United States is all about individual freedom. And the countries that we're talking about, and Sharia law is not at all about the individual.
No.
It's essentially codifying, you know, a religious commandments on behalf of a leader, and you know, everybody else, you know, is subservient. So there's a total disconnect between how people are seen and see themselves in the Sharia context. You know, if they're going to make it a holy law, and the individualism that characterizes our, you know, the protection of individual rights, which is so, it just doesn't make any sense in the context of Sharia. So when you say religious freedom in this country is so paramount, and then you forget that the separation of church and state is also paramount, that is totally off the board when you talk about Sharia, because Sharia law is religion and law melded together.
No, absolutely, no question about that. And my main concern with this is with what's going on in the Middle East right now. They're moving, they're gaining strength, and if we're not very careful, within a couple of years, we're going to be at war. And I think it's going to be a very interesting thing to see what happens if Israel is attacked and we drag our feet and don't step in there to help. It's going to be.
Yeah, I think it's going to be that. I agree with you, and that I know that was big in Gaffney's article. And I think that you know, Israel is essentially besieged by increasingly, you know, it's been a stable. We've had the illusion of stability, and actually even some real stability when there have been numerous dictators, which frankly we've had something to do with keeping in power in the past in that area. You know, our hands aren't really clean when it comes to the Middle East, as far as who we've supported and who we've you know, given weapons to and who we've outfitted and everything. It's kind of checkered our record with them. But overall, you know, the plain fact remains that if you take Israel out of the equation, that is just disaster. Time.
We have no identity. We will have no identity there whatsoever. The United States won't have an identity there. And it grows. And I think one of the major things that you and I have talked about, we've discussed over the years, is that we are the most potent force in the world. Toe-to-toe, you don't stand up to the United States. So if you want to destroy us, you go internally. What you do is you get us to implode. You separate us. You divide
us.
You get rid of our economy. And that's what's going on right now. In my heart of hearts, I will never understand, and it's all over the news, I will never understand why that we owe so much money to China, and I get it, because, you know, we buy things from China, obviously, and they also build their army, but we buy things from China, and at the same time, how many hundreds of millions of dollars are we giving them for human, what do I want to say? I lost the word. We're adding to their... Oh, here we go. 4:00 in the morning. I'll call you. You older folks, I know what this is like. We're I lost the word I wanted to use, but we send money to them to support their people who don't have enough to eat and housing and so on and so forth. Human rights.
Oh, I see. Yeah. The human programs, human welfare programs.
Yes. We owe them trillions of dollars, and we're paying them absorbent in interest, and at the same time, we're giving them money to support their programs. Where is the logic in that?
Well, you know what, Michael, as far as money goes, and as far as I know that you just had a financial, you know, expert on with you, and as far as money goes, I mean it's my opinion that the international financial community is essentially not tied to national interests outside of places like China. I mean, China is essentially keeping control as much as they can of their population. Sure. But the moneyed classes that operate internationally, I mean, I don't want to sound like a socialist here, but there isn't too much there's not too much responsibility that they appear to feel for any national interest, even in their own home countries.
No, got it. Oh, by the way, that doesn't sound socialist. And then when you really come down to it, it's what are we doing with our own economy? And we talk about all of the things that are going on in the Middle East and so on and so forth. We're destroying ourselves right here. We have a tremendous amount of dropout rate in the schools. They say education. That's not education. There's no incentive for the kids to stay in. There was 30-some-odd percent of the jobs that were available that haven't been filled because they can't find the people with the ability to fill the jobs. Big problem, education system. So, you know, this is kind of a reversible cause and effect here. And if we don't do something to stop it, I think Pat Buchanan in some of the things that he said was right. If you move on to 2040, what we're going to see basically is not political uprising, but we're going to be seeing groups, factions fighting each other. Black against white, Hispanic against black, this one against that one. And I think that's
really... And it's going to be economically. Yeah, it's economically determined, probably.
Yes. And that's what's going on right now. This country, I have never... Kathy, I've never seen us divided like this in my entire life. And
I haven't either. No. Yeah. No. It's really sad. And you know, the impasse in Washington, is just... It's making everybody in the country furious, but also there's no alternative to it. You know, no one can point to an alternative. There's just incitements to riot from every side.
How about $2-3 trillion sitting underneath the earth here in the United States in oil revenue? I mean, if we really wanted to economically get out of this, we'd start drilling for oil. We wouldn't give somebody $500 million to go start a plant for an electric car and have that car built in another country. And on top of that, I don't know if you know the stats on it, it's only good for 35 miles. Then the gas engine kicks in and you get 19 miles the gallon, and that'll cost you $80,000. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. You know, over the years, my hair got a little thinner, and so I'm not going to pull it out.
Yeah, me neither.
I gotcha. Okay. We just about ran out of time. Website we can find you at?
We're at homelandinsecuritytheblog.com, Michael.
Wonderful. And we will see you. You're going to be in town for a while? Your town.
Absolutely will. Absolutely
will. We'll see you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Good night, Kathy.
Okay. Good night.
As long as you're singing, there's a bell up in your brain that's ringing,
making a crazy ding-dong.
And if this band don't desert us,
then there's nothing in the world can hurt us. Long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicatos.
add some rhythm. As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing now, long as we're singing now, long as we're singing.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Gene O'Carroll with us. He is the author of Soul of a Lifter. He's a football coach, a gym owner, a writer, former police officer, and a former law enforcement college professor. Recently wrote his first nonfiction book titled, again, The Soul of a Lifter. And after a decade of writing 19 editions and 6 best-selling law enforcement textbooks, he's got it, and he's right there. And let's say, Gino, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for being here. The Soul of a Lifter. You know, I've always felt in my heart of hearts that if somebody starts working out when they're young and they bring it forward to the young adult and then middle age and as they get older, There's a discipline behind it that most people miss even when it gets into their work life, relationship life, or anything else. There is a soul to a lifter, isn't there?
I couldn't agree more with you. You've actually presented a great narrative of the book. That's one of many of the messages I'm trying to bring across, because you said it very well. What you do at an early stage in life, I believe with all my heart, those habits will continue on, whether they're positive or they're negative. And in my case, there really is a soul of a lifter. I chose that title because of multiple meanings. But one meaning of soul of a lifter is that there was a force inside me that led me to a transformation. I was an obese, dysfunctional 12-year-old child.
Yeah.
And I came to a crossroads. I did not have a strength coach. I did not have a personal trainer. I was playing little league football, and I had some very, negative experiences. And it's not trying to play the victim. What I'm saying is, obese children. I think obesity is a form of it attracts some sort of derogatory or discrimination. I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, but it happened to me, and I honestly believe that there's experiences that kids suffer because of their weight. I was nearing my high school career. I wanted to continue my high school football career, and I had to lose my obesity because it was getting to be a big problem. I started lifting weights inexplicably. Now, what I mean by inexplicably, no one led me to it. I attributed it to an inner force, which I call the soul of a lifter. Within 6 years, I had transformed myself, but earlier than that, I had what I consider to be a very successful high school football career. As a grade 9 freshman, I played both junior varsity and varsity. That's a big status symbol on campus. At the age of 18 years and 3 months, whether it's right or wrong, but I got hired in policing. I've always wondered about the debate whether or not that's too young, but at 18 years and 3 months, I went from an obese, dysfunctional, unable to make eye contact, unable to function in a social setting. I got by a grueling 2.5-hour interview, a huge selection process with over 660 candidates. 2 of us got hired, not because we were superheroes as TV wants to show, but we had some qualities. I'd worked in a factory during my high school career that was my high school job, was backbreaking work. The common theme was hard work, physical work. And the physical work really liberated a lot of forces inside me. Intellectually, I became a better student in school, graduated every year with honor roll. And again, this is anecdotal, it's my experience, but my confidence soared. By the time I was 26, by the time I was 20, I was on my particular police force's first SWAT team. By the time I was 26, I was in a detective office and got appointed head coach of a high school football team, which is my true calling. At that year, talk about soul of a lifter. My second meaning is on how you can transfer the experience of one soul of a lifter and how you could connect with others. My first year as a head coach was a unmitigated failure. It was a nightmare, yeah, by football standards. One win, nine losses in the off season. My wife and I started I already had a gym down our home basement. We expanded it because our team didn't have a weight room. And everybody worked out for 9 months. Next year, we went from 9-1. We transformed to an undefeated perfect season of 10-0. And it's not just about the winning. It's about the experience. We saw people transform themselves from scrawny to out-of-shape fat kids. They transformed. And not only transformed, but they moved on to levels of football that they became pioneers. I'm from Canada. Having a Canadian player at that time getting recruited by U.S. schools wasn't as free as it is today. And so many of these kids were transformed by the same mechanism, working out. Working out proved to me, and I've had now a 40-year or 40-season football coaching career, there's a huge connection between mind and body. When you're physically strong, I think it'll help you get through any kind of adversity, beat the odds. It make you mentally strong, intellectually strong, emotionally strong, spiritually strong. I think strength is connected. I think it's built on a thread, on a continuum.
No question about it. I want to take you back to a couple of things. The failure that you talked about. There's no such thing as a failure. Look what it built everybody into. I think the biggest thing that kids, especially today, miss is that ability to compete. When I was in high school, you won or you lost a game. Okay, so you lost, you got better the next time, and you went. Everybody didn't have a pin saying, everybody gets a medal because they played. It was you had to get better in working out. Is also competitive, not professionally competitive, but you're in there with the gym, maybe you got a workout partner, there's other people around, you want to get bigger than the next guy, and so on and so forth, and it instills that competition. You get frustrated. So instead of taking it out on people, your family, your business, your whatever, you go work out. By the time you're done, the frustration's gone, you're back to where you were. You want a bigger body, you have to have an image of the body while you're working out. So you're right, it's a total and complete connection. And what that connection is, it's the base of who we are as a country and the way we were created and the way we were put together. Canada, too. It's the same.
Very well said. I agree. I am first-generation Italian-Canadian. I saw up close, personal, the struggles of my parents coming here or coming to Canada from a war-torn devastation that their struggles I'll never be able to match. I believe our society was built on struggles from all over, that our predecessors went through struggles that, just in my case, I can't match what my parents went through. So no. I learned that struggle through struggle will come outcomes, positive outcomes, beyond what we right now at this very moment can believe. And I agree with you about the failure. The reason I use the word failure is that as a teacher, as a coach, as a former cop, I use the word failure for a number of meanings. One is a workout meaning. The closer you come to failure in the gym, meaning total failure, the bigger your body will get. And not just in terms of big muscle. It'll repair stronger. And I also liberally use the word failure in the sense of there's nothing wrong with failure because what I learned in football is this. You have to study failure. You study it, and you will learn every lesson that you need to learn for winning by whatever definition that you want to attach to winning. And I know a lot of people attach it just to the scoreboard. I believe the scoreboard's good evidence, both in life, business, any profession, sports. But there's several deeper meanings to the word winning. And one of them is just closing the gap. You mentioned earlier about just competing in the gym. Competing against self is one of the biggest positives that I've ever felt in my life. Every day that you go into the gym, I don't care if you run, I don't care if you're in a cardio class, any type of exercise, you're competing against self first. And I've always believed in any walk of life, our biggest opponent is right inside. It's right in our mind. And it's a work in progress trying to beat that. So before you can line up and win, quote unquote, against an opponent, you've got to do some exploration about yourself first. You got to beat the temptation to quit at the earliest onset of discomfort, for example. And the gym, to me, it's not just a case of making big muscles, but it's been 42 years of uninterrupted, no steroids, no performance-enhancing drugs. It's been a personal struggle. I'll use the word struggle, but it's part of my life. And it's funny, tonight on the way in here, I heard on the radio, a radio host used the word fitness freak. I don't consider myself to be a fitness freak. It's funny that people don't use the word freak for other, you know, antisocial behaviors. This is part of my life. People work out for a variety of reasons. I'm not a bodybuilder. Whatever people want to do with their fitness is perfectly fine with me. I do it for a number of different reasons, and I've tried to transfer it to thousands of student-athletes and thousands of law enforcement college students that I've always preached. Build yourself up physically. Build yourself up mentally. They're connected. Your mindset matters. Your mindset is developed through physical activity and vice versa. Intellectual activity will lead you to physical activity. And it's that endless connection. And that's what I'm trying to explore in the book. The book is an exploration of my own personal experiences. I'm trying to show some synchronicity that happens in life. I wrote a criminal investigation textbook years ago, and one of my investigative theories that I learned was there is no such thing as a coincidence as a starting point in an investigation. If you think something's a coincidence, there's probably a strong connection until you prove it otherwise. Because if you believe in coincidences in frontline investigations, you're sorely going to be not only mistaken, you're going to make some big mistakes. So you have to have a different mindset. You got to see the connection first and then try to prove that it was a coincidence. Because generally, coincidences are connections. And in the book, that's a strong theme. I used that investigative theme that I've tried to sew a thread through not only my life, but the life of some extraordinary people who are characters, very unconventional characters, because I'm an unconventional football coach, I'm an unconventional business owner, and I've tried to convey that to my students and my athletes. And the book itself is an unconventional genre for a number of different reasons, but one of the things is there's a thread of unconventional characters that have a very, very strong connection. One of them is working out. One of them is working out. So I've tried to, this is the first in a series. It was impossible for me to try to get my entire message across, but it was my very first, it's my rookie book outside of the academic textbook genre. And it was a tremendous learning experience, but I am still a rookie at it. And I fully intend on trying to become a pro at it someday.
Now, by the way, you know, we've only got a couple of minutes to go. We're running out of time. But I have been a bodybuilder for probably 50 years, so you're preaching to the choir here. And one of the things that I've noticed, which I thought was really good about it, what not so much about me, but other people, or even myself, you get frustrated about something. It's called turn it into exercise. Turn it into that exercise to get rid of all that stress and everything else that's bothering you. I watched a woman work out in the gym about a year and a half ago. And you've seen people in there. They'll get in there and they'll kind of slop their way through it, and they're not really putting any energy into it. And I walked by her, and I said, "Is anybody you really can't stand?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Put them in front of you and take it on the weights." That woman had the best workout she ever had. But it was constructive. It was using it for something that truly, really worked. And I really believe everything that you've said tonight, why and how most of us were brought up in the mindset that we had. I don't know what's going on today, but that was a mindset that worked. And I hope everybody gets the book. Gino, is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's www, and my full name, Gino Arcaro, G-I-N-O-A-R-C-A-R-O, .com. Just www.ginoarcaro.com, or with the title of the book, www.soulofalifter, all one word, .com.
Wonderful. Hey, Gino, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Take care. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtains fall. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
It's a wrap.
Say it again.
It's a wrap.
It's a wrap from both ends.
Yes.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends,